wooden pole as well. And they had to make sure that you only get a paper.
that you can download directly. That's okay. Just anything to avoid going to the library. Isn't that true? Is that what you guys are doing? Anything? No. Okay. Some of you are not. That's fine. Absolutely. You mean highlighted?
Amino acid homology.
Yes, but are you saying that you have one sequence highlighted on your protein that is an amino acid sequence homolog?
Even though it's structurally it's an amino acid also.
It's not necessarily. It would depend. Did you do multi-line?
Yes.
Okay. So it depends. If you have done multi-line, you might be dramatically dismayed to find that a lot of your proteins are not sequentially homologous.
But the G,
G. Yes, that's fine. And if you want to highlight that, that's great. You are not required, I don't believe, I dropped multi-line out of the requirement because it would take a lot more time to do a sequence analysis of your proteins. But if you want to, don't be amazed if your proteins are really not homologous in terms of their sequence. It's the space. That's what the Dava server is doing, is showing how they look in space. Any questions whatsoever? I haven't even been on email yet today, just in case you're wondering why I haven't replied. I have this haunting suspicion that there's lots of emails, so I hope I'm getting a lot of your questions answered here. You should do that. Yes, Andy? By looking at the two overlapping where you're supposed to.
When you have the superposition picture, how does it help you determine where each molecule is?
You're going to have to guess where they're homologous. That's what I'm saying. If you've only got a small section, you can probably trace the backbone. If you've got the whole overview, look for things in SQD1 that you're used to identifying. Look for the Rossum fold. If you can see where that is, then you can see where yours is with relation to that. You can, in many cases, select things that you've already selected in SQD1. You can select them in the overlap view. And that might also give you some idea as to what is actually homologous. If you know, for instance, the sequence of amino acids that make the Rossum fold, select it on your 3D overlap and see whether that's where the homolog is positioned. But taking a guess is just fine. I mean, the overlap will show me where the homology is. So don't worry that you have to do exactly that residue on any of your RAS model. I don't care if you don't highlight that at all. I highlight other specific things that you think play an important part of the function or the structure of your RAS model. Okay? Okay, remember there's a museum on. Yes?
Did you want the article with the report?
Did I want
the. Did you want us to put the article?
No, it's just going to make, don't put on the numbers to make an extra copy of that. Think of all the plants and what they do for us. Everything. Exam, Friday, 10 to 12, your last exam. That's cause for celebration alone, isn't it? And you might think that's why the bagels are in here today, but they're not. They're in here because this is the lecture on insulin and glucagon. So I am feeding to help you see firsthand the effects of hormonal signals. Okay, that's the key. So again, let's make this real casual. You come down here anytime and help yourself to this one piece. There's a lot of things left, so feel free to come down at any time. Let's review. This, by the way, is a great diagram. It's on page 756 in Leninger. Let's review what we've looked at so far. For all of our studies to date, the catabolic and the anabolic pathways, we've pretty much been focused on three different kinds of cells in us. Those kinds of cells are the liver cells, the hepatocytes, which has a very extensive role in all catabolic and anabolic functions. We focus on muscle cells. Do you remember the first bypass? It's that really ornate one that goes out into the mitochondria, out of the mitochondria, that has a very complex one with the pyruvate carboxylase and two other enzymes, the malate dehydrogenase. So that's the first very ornate bypass. The second bypass would be which one? It's the bypass of PFK1. So it's done by F16-bisphosphatase. Guys, I know, just remember the abbreviations are fine, FPPH. But the third and final bypass, please. Hexokinase bypass is what? What is the enzyme? Hexokinase doesn't reverse itself. HDL, LDL, you should know that whole trafficking idea. Just to call it serial trafficking. So it's got a very unique role, and that's just the liver. Muscle is the matter of the liver. What is muscle's main goal? Activity. That's its main goal. All activity, all the time, even when muscle is actually active by most cellular standards. So it has very little glycogen stores because look at the mass of the muscle cell. No. They're not big in size. They're not a big organ. Individual skeletal muscle, for instance. So it has very little glycogen stores. It breaks it down in times of activity immediately to glucose 1 phosphate and then glucose 6 phosphate. It is trapped, and the skeletal muscle, for instance, goes directly into glycolysis. Or creating the pharmacy. insulin with, and versus, we have a competition, insulin versus glucagon, and it's mainly in the liver. Okay? So let's talk a little bit more about what these hormones hormonal signals. How does a hormone work? It is produced by very specialized cells in organs or in glands. So we're mainly talking about hormones like the peptide and the amine hormones. Okay, we're not talking about those steroid-derived hormones that are locally produced and locally effectors. They are transported through the bloodstream, which tells you a little bit about their solubility. They target only those cells that have specific receptors. These are, of course, I better put it up here, peptide and amines. Because at the very end, we talk about steroid hormones, and those have a different mode of activity. Specific receptors. That means they don't just get picked up from the bloodstream wherever there's a low concentration and have their effects in those cells. They actually target only very specific cells. So when those glands turn on the production of these hormones, they're going through your bloodstream at high levels. And turning off that signal means that it will take some time for the bloodstream's hormonal levels to decrease. There is a turnover time involved. So with every hormonal signal, the key has to be, and for every signal at all, for every signal in every cell all the time, the key to signaling is that there has to be an on and an off switch. Otherwise, it's not a signal. Otherwise, it's just a continuum. So the regulation of all these hormones is involved with how to turn on the signal and how to turn that signal off by itself. There has to be, to some extent, the auto-regulation. And that's what we focus on. Now, if it is a signal, it somehow is a pulse. It is not a continuous thing, so that what would be the point of signaling then? Then you have to have another signal come around and turn it off. Consider auto-regulation. That's really important. And how do cells determine what effects those particular hormones will have on them? Well, the individual cells that are targeted by hormones can choose how to have those effects. And one of the ways that cells can choose is by putting what receptors it has on its surface. If a cell produces a receptor to a particular hormone, that means that it wants to be turned on or off by that hormone's activities. The cell types can regulate hormonal influence by having receptors or not having receptors, having receptors at high concentration on the cell surface, or low concentration. Where have we seen this before? Having nothing to do with hormones. What kinds of cells can say kind of tailor, oh, I want to have this much of that receptor on my surface, or I want to bring it in and hold it within in a vesicle so that it can't be targeted? Yes, LDL receptors. Okay? They going to transcribe, translate, and make on the cell surface. They can also change the kinds of second messengers that are turned on by these receptors. We're going to talk about that in a minute. And they can ultimately determine the kind of effects that these hormones will have by choosing which enzymes are going to be turned on ultimately by the second messengers. By selectively having enzymes like glucose-6-phosphatase, or choosing not to have that enzyme, like the skeletal muscle. What enzymes it has, those are the ones that will be affected by the hormonal cascade. Just knowing that if you take certain, it's the same thing with vitamin therapies. you can increase certain levels of vitamins, and that can help a lot of neurological processes, a lot of things that the metabolic basis isn't known. What the body is doing with it isn't known, but it's been correlated with increasing lipid production and increased rebuilding and regeneration. That's not to say it's bad. It's just not. It's not benefiting you in the way that you think it is. It can't. A little bit of biochemistry can be anybody's nightmare who goes to GNC or who goes to a pediatrician or ever to a pediatrician. Because I've always said I'm not a pediatrician's worst nightmare. And you can do that too. Okay? That was a little sad one, but it was still fun, wasn't it? So let's go on to what is actually going on. Are you feeling the effects of what you've eaten? What are you feeling? You tell me what you're feeling. Those of you who actually started chewing on these things. Should I send them to you? Should I send them to you? Can we get out of the way? I can't just wait, though. What are you doing? Are you feeling sleepy? Yes, you're feeling sleepy. Do you know why? Because you are in debt. Because you're thinking to yourself, wait a minute, I just ate. And I've got all these carbohydrates, and they should be circling. And they are circling. Except the energy that you expended in chewing has put you in debt. Okay? It's in debt. You have eaten. And also, you have eaten for a while before, actually, imbibing these things. You're thinking to yourself, okay, so while you've eaten basically simple sugars, that's basically what the carbohydrate is, that's the basis. The cream cheese, I mean, sometimes you have to make those simple sugars taste a little bit better, but you have eaten simple sugars. But you've chewed that, and bagels are notoriously chewing. And the chewing process has not only probably made your jaws ache, depending on how many you've eaten, but has actually put you in a little bit of skeletal muscle debt. And why, if your jaws are aching, why are they aching? Because you were chewing so quickly that lactic acid was building up there, and now it's being transported to the liver for regeneration, the glucose. Okay? But the good thing for you is glucose is on the way. Because your stomach has started digestive processes. And as a direct result of eating this, ultimately, within half an hour, probably, you will have a much elevated glucose concentration. And that elevation will be seen. And it will be seen immediately. And as the high blood glucose increases, insulin is produced by the pancreas. It says, okay, I've got a lot of glucose. Insulin is sent out. And insulin targets every single cell that contains an insulin receptor. And insulin receptors are pretty much the easiest kind of receptor system, so we'll start with those. So we're at that first level of regulation. Only the cells that have a receptor will feel the effects of what you eat. What does the insulin receptor look like? This is a nice little drawing. On page 770 in Leninger, and I'll draw it in a cartoon-like way for you. Four subunits, two each of two different kinds of subunits, cell surface. It's kind of like legs sticking into the cell. So you have two of these shorter subunits. I'll point them out here. These extracellular domains, the alpha domains, these are the ones that actually bind to the insulin itself. are the ones that have the adaptive function of these receptors. This catalytic function is the phosphorylating of anything in its immediate vicinity that can be phosphorylated. So this receptor is itself an enzyme with kinase activity. They are kinases. And specifically, they are tyrosine kinases. Meaning they put phosphates, the group itself, on tyrosine residues of proteins that can take phosphates. So there it is, it shows this particular cytosolic domain. Let's move it up a little bit. And the key is the binding of insulin to these receptors causes a huge conformational change in the whole protein. What in effect happens is that these domains, the intracellular domains, climb into each other. They have this huge shift, and they actually climb into each other. And almost as if it were spontaneous, ATP in the cytosol is used to phosphorylate the receptor itself. So, ATP, at the expense of ATP, you put phosphate groups on tyrosine residues that are actually in this protein, this part of the protein chain. This is so-called autophosphorylation. So they're climbing into each other, ATP is in the cytosol, and phosphate get put on the individual domain. And once they're on one domain, that domain can phosphorylate another domain. And they go back and forth and phosphorylate each other, whichever happens to be in the area of ATP at that time. So they can do this continuous kind of phosphorylation then. They can put phosphorylation on their cells, different tyrosine residues of the other domain. So they're literally littered with phosphates now decorating their intracellular domain, only on tyrosine residues. And what happens is, of course, these are membrane-bound proteins, these receptors, and they can slide along the membrane. And they do. And they slide along, and guess what they run into every now and then? Other receptors. Other insulin receptors. So what happens is kind of slide into another guy. And what do you think will happen to its intracellular domains? Phosphorylation. Until you have basically a pool of insulin receptors that are heavily phosphorylated in their intracellular side. And those phosphorylations allow them to run into other cytosolic proteins. Cytosolic proteins like kinase, for instance, that can become phosphorylated and become active, or become active in reverse, right? And you have to be careful about enzymes, which way you're activating them. For instance, it could run into glycogen synthase versus glycogen phosphorylase. It can run into the enzymes that directly phosphorylate synthase and phosphorylase. So you can imagine these guys, the insulin receptors, tyrosine kinase activity, ultimately can be felt to other cytosolic proteins that are floating around and happen to run into, because they have a specific domain that will run into these intracellular tyrosine-containing domains. And what kinds of proteins do you think it will phosphorylate or regulate? What is insulin a sign of? You have high glucose in your blood. It's only sent out when you have high glucose. What is it signaling? It's got plenty. Don't make more. So what kinds of pathways will it affect? In the liver? What does it say? Glycogen production. Glycogen production. Should you be breaking down your glycogen reserves? Why not? You've got most of glucose being transported in directly from the bloodstream. What should you be doing if you're in the skeletal muscle? Glycolysis. And the muscles are saying, break down, break down. What else are you saying in the skeletal muscle? Storage. Storage. You can have plenty of glucose coming in. Store this. Make creatine phosphate. Have a storage of this high energy molecule because you have plenty of energy to make the ATP, and you can directly transfer that energy into this high energy intermediate, so creatine kinase, which is effective. Store creatine phosphate. It's a high energy intermediate. You've got plenty of glucose coming in, and you've got plenty of glycolysis between your brain, plenty of this ATP. It's there in high quantities. Drive it into the production of something that can be stored in high quantities in the skeletal muscle. Okay, insulin. No signal is a signal unless it can be turned off. Okay? So, how do you think insulin receptor can turn off its activity? For every single system that we look at, we have to consider how is it turned off. How is the receptor itself turned off? We've already talked about all of these things. Only the cells that have an insulin receptor will bind to the insulin. Those are the only cells that will feel this cascade. The second messengers are what proteins are on the receiving end of this high-receiving kinase activity. What enzymes? That's the same thing for this one, because you don't have a very big cascade. Wait till we get to the next cascade. Then you'll see the cascade. So how do you regulate it? No signal works unless there's a method to turn it off. Of course, you could always just shut down insulin production, right? So that's one level where you can shut this down. But still, there will be insulin circulating in the blood for quite some time after you stop producing it. The concentrations will go down very slowly. There's a turnover rate for these signal molecules. So you have to have a more direct shutoff mechanism. Any receptor will only be turned on in a pulse. That means ultimately this receptor has to be shut down directly by something that happens in the cell. And that happens because way down here, protein after protein after protein, ultimately you phosphorylate a protein. Comes back around and phosphorylates this enzyme, this receptor, this tyrosine kinase activity on a serine or a threonine residue, and it shuts it off. Okay, ultimately, way down the line, phosphorylation of a protein that specifically phosphorylates the receptor, and not at the tyrosine, of course, because that would just serve to add more tyrosine kinase activity, but add a serine or threonine, and it's shut down. That's one way it is known when it gets phosphorylated at a residue other than the tyrosine kinase activity. This receptor is another conformational change. The insulin is booted back out and it is shut off. So it's an automatic thing. It does it itself. Autoregulation, self-regulation of this enzyme that is part of the receptor. Another way, there's been some talk over the years, this has been talked, about the insulin receptor actually becoming internalized, like the LDL receptor. Because a lot of insulin receptor is found in internal vesicles. So that's a great method. That's how you shut down LDL receptor activity. What do? Bring it into the cell. It can no longer bind insulin, so it's shut off. Okay? Those are the methods that it can be turned off in the most straightforward way. The insulin receptor is one of the simplest second messenger systems. or it contains one of the regulation at the point of what receptor you have, regulation at the point of what enzymes are turned on. Let's look at another, a little bit more complicated receptor system. Epinephrine. Okay, hopefully by now, of course you are writing, so that's a good sign. Epinephrine, and for that matter, glucagon, belong to what is called the adrenergic system of receptors. Specifically, glucagon is considered to take part in what is called the beta adrenergic receptor system. Somatostatin connects with receptors that are part of the alpha-2 adrenergic system, so it's a whole family of receptors that fall under this category. Gotten the name, of course. Can you think of where it got it? Adrenaline. It's the receptor that was found to be directly involved in binding adrenaline, which has since changed its name to epinephrine. So, epinephrine binds to these receptors. Glucagon binds to these receptors. Of course, adrenaline will bind to these receptors in what kinds of cells? Mostly skeletal muscle. Glucagon will bind to these kinds of receptors that are carried in what kinds of cells? Mostly hepatocytes, so liver cells. Somatostatin binds to receptors from this family, and depending on exactly their composition, their exact sequence, their exact specificity, there are a whole bunch of different receptors that fall into this category. Alpha-1, alpha-2, I think there's even alpha-3, but beta-1, beta. They had the number of the beta adrenergic receptors is what we talk about for mostly epinephrine and glucagon. This is the main one, and it's what we're going to follow first. The beta adrenergic receptor system. There's a great little description of what goes on page 763 in your book if you want to follow along. It is a receptor that is produced and put on biological membranes. It's kind of different than the insulin receptor in its general structure. And in fact, it has no catalytic activity by itself. It does not specifically catalyze reactions, not like the insulin receptor, which is, in an intracellular domain, an enzyme. This is not. This is a receptor that's mostly forming a structural role. It has a binding site. So this could be, I think your book has epinephrine binding to it. This could be epinephrine or glucagon that basically go through the same series of events. Just depends on which cell you're talking about. First level of regulation. Which cells you're talking about, that will determine which hormone, I mean which receptor you have, and also which enzymes are inside and can be turned on and off. Binding of, and maybe by now you're getting hungry. Are you getting hungry again? You can always come up for more bagels if you are getting hungry. But if you are getting hungry, that's a sure sign that glucagon has been sent out. And glucagon is saying to the cells, okay, wait a minute, you're in low blood sugar now. When your glucose in your bloodstream gets to below a certain point, a certain number of milligrams per deciliter, certainly insulin, diabetes patients with insulin problems. It gets below that point, it drops below that threshold concentration. What happens? Glucagon is made, glucagon is sent through the bloodstream, and glucagon hits those cells in the liver especially quickly. They bind to their receptor, part of the beta adrenergic family, and a huge conformational change occurs in this receptor. And this receptor has, kind of in an intramolecular interaction kind of way, attached to it, not covalently, but just closely associated with it, a system of proteins called, it belongs to a family of genes called the RAS family of genes, but they're called G proteins. Not for G whiz, but instead, GTP binding. And these proteins, this whole family, comes from a whole family of RAS genes. I'm sure you've probably heard that name before. The RAS family of genes is a big oncogene family. A lot of cancers are a direct result of having misproducts. They are mutants, or somehow they've been altered in this family of proteins, and they can cause horrible effects and uncontrolled cell division and uncontrolled cell growth, tumor promotion right there from this family. And it's the G protein family, and they're involved in many cellular processes. This is only one of them. They're involved in huge numbers, the RAS, the RAB, the RAM, all of them that are directly related, and their whole job is to bind GTP and hydrolyze it. But what it's interacting with while it's doing its job is causing conformational changes in those proteins that it's interacting with and turning on and off their activity. So its whole job is to bind GTP and move around and hit and run into other proteins. There are three subunits on a typical GTP binding protein. The alpha subunit is the catalytic subunit. The beta and gamma are basically regulatory. So, when GTP is bound to this alpha subunit, what happens is it has this conformation. It puts it in close proximity to, actually cozying up to, its beta and gamma subunits. And the gamma subunit of this protein, this class of proteins, actually adheres very nicely to the beta adrenergic receptor. Okay, so these are in close proximity. They are closely, they're not covalently bound, but they are in close attachment. Non-covalently. So when GDP is bound, this threesome is tightly adherent to this receptor. When the receptor binds to its hormone, what happens is there's a shuffle. GTP boots out the GDP, and the binding of this alpha subunit to GTP causes such a huge conformational change in that subunit that it sails away from the alpha, from the beta and gamma subunits. It actually goes sailing across the intramembrane leaf. Right, this is a bilayer. This alpha subunit is actually kind of cozying up to that phospholipid head along this bilayer, and it gets sent out. It binds GTP, and it gets sent out with a skating along the membrane at its intracellular surface. And it skates along, and remember this is a cell, so this is three-dimensional. This is skating in all directions, and it's in this GTP-bound stage. So it's skating until it runs into a protein that in this conformation it actually attaches to, not covalently, but intramolecularly. And the protein that it attaches to is also a membrane-bound protein, right here. Your book calls it adenylate cyclase. Other books call it adenylate. So don't be worried if you see any different spellings. Adenylate cyclase or adenylate. stoichiometric thing here where one epinephrine is bound to one receptor and one GTP protein is floating along to one adenylyl cyclase? It's not. Remember, this is happening in three dimensions. So it's not like they're in an electron transport chain and one of these is directed to the other. This is scanning all over. And it's taking as many of these adenylate cyclases as it can. And when it hits it, it turns on the adenylate cyclase. And the adenylate cyclase has a cytosolic domain that does a very important catalytic event. It makes a second messenger. Proteins were directly affected by the insulin receptor itself. But in this case, the receptor has no activity, and this concentration, this internal, if you will, metabolite, increases dramatically, and it has cellular effects. So with the second messenger, its levels increase as a direct result of adenylate cyclase, which is only turned on by the alpha subunit of the GTP binding protein. And which is now ultimately leading back to the receptor binding event. Direct effects, indirect effects. Directly it's turned on by this enzyme making it, but that enzyme is turned on by GTP binding protein attaching to it, and that's turned on by the hormone binding to the receptor. Okay, so it keeps going, and cyclic AMP is made in a lot, in huge concentration, a lot of events. So it's often thought that second messenger systems and these cascades that directly result, no matter how many steps are in between, from hormonal binding events are giving you what you would call amplification of your signal. You get an amplified signal with every second messenger that is turned on as a result of this hormonal binding event. You don't just make one cyclic AMP for every one hormone binding. You make 7 billion cyclic AMP for every one hormone binding event. So your signal is now 7 million times stronger within the cell. With every second messenger. Okay? So beyond that, yep.
Is the glucagon that binds to the protein, is that what stimulates the GTP to attach to the...
Yes. It's what makes the first placement. It binds to its beta and gamma subunit only when GTP is in that pocket. When GTP boots out the GTP, so basically you're losing your GTP that was bound and you're putting in place of it a GTP, a high energy molecule, that sends it sliding along. So what do you think sends it sliding back? driver license GTP. That's a whole job. So as long as it still has GTP bound, it will be in search of it then like 5 weeks in every direction. And transit will bind to it and turn it on until it makes a lot of sight of the ambient. And then it'll bounce off of that and go to another one maybe. But at a certain point, it's actually going to do its catalytic event. And what's it going to do? It's going to hydrolyze that terminal phosphate on the GTP. And what will then be in its place? GDP. And where will it go? And that's the main way that this has a shutoff switch. It has only GTP bound for as long as it can keep it in its active site before it actually does its job, hydrolyzes the third phosphate, and has GDP, and then it has a different conformation that makes it bounce back into the beta and gamma subunits. So let's actually try that. The regulation for these types of receptors at the first level, the GTPase activity of the G protein. Okay? That's the first way that that's regulated. There's another enzyme, actually, that's affected by other hormone signals that we'll get to tomorrow, that actually breaks down cyclic AMP. This enzyme is acyclic AMP and turns it just into AMP. There's another way in which regulation happens. So it's no longer at the point of the receptor anymore that you're regulating this cascade. You're actually shutting down and reversing production of a signal molecule. This enzyme that does this is called phosphodiesterase. And we get into this in a big way. Tomorrow we talk about another cascade and whatever it turns this enzyme on. Okay. How many of you have heard about cholera toxin? Cholera toxin results in a direct result of an infection that causes the alpha subunit to be what is called ADP ribosylated. It actually gets in places of GTP that's put on it, you get a covalent attachment of an ADP ribose, which effectively turns this alpha subunit on constantly. So cholera toxin is a direct result, or directly results in turning this on constantly, making all of your cells that are affected by this hormonal cascade turned on constantly, and you end up with a series of symptoms that are a direct result of this guy being permanently affixed in its on position. And I think that whooping cough, the pertussis toxin, affects the inhibitory subunit, which we can talk about in a minute. There's another somatostatin, it's a receptor that has, instead of an active G, what we call GS protein, a stimulatory G protein, this one, it actually activates an inhibitory protein, a GR. Okay, what happened to this one? Cyclic AMP levels increasing in the cell. Let's follow this with completion, and then we'll talk about somatostatin and others. What happens? Inside the cell, cyclic AMP is a huge concentration. And it specifically binds to proteins, and those specific proteins that bind it quickly, there's one specific one that is called protein kinase, you know? what do you think that effect will be? If it phosphorylates B kinase and activates it, then phosphorylates B kinase will phosphorylate B. And what will it do? Activate phosphorylates B, and the glycogen breakdown will begin. Stimulate fructose 2,6 bisphosphatase. Why? That's that signal molecule. When glucagon is high, the signal molecule is diminished. 2,6 bisphosphate is the activator for glycolysis. And in the liver, you don't want glycolysis going on. In the liver, your focus is producing glucose. You've got no glucose as a signal. So the liver is saying, okay, I'm in trouble. I want to shut down glycolysis, which means my PNPA1 has to be inhibited. So I'm going to effectively lower the concentration of fructose 2,6 bisphosphate. That signal molecule that does that. And that means there's less activation of PNPA1. Don't get lost in the cycles here. You're very complicated. So just get the major input. What's the problem? Glucagon, low sugar. You're getting hungry, you're for glucose production. The liver has to produce glucose, and the muscle has to make itself use the glucose that the liver is sending out. So that's the cascade. Now, each activation event doesn't just result in one other activation event. So every time you have this release, you have these enzymes active for as long as they can do their job before cyclic AMP is released and lowered enough in concentration for these to swing back to the regulatory subunits. So again, you have amplification. It doesn't just do one phosphorylation event. It does thousands because it's active for that amount of time. Same with this. When it activates phosphorylated B kinase, it doesn't just mean phosphorylated B kinase turns around and does one activation. I'm like to phosphorylate. It does lots of it, so you get amplification again. Now it seems to me this hormonal cascade runs circles around this one. You see why? I mean, this guy has almost virtually no second messengers, none that you can identify as being consistent with every cell. It's got its own activity. It's rather simple and beautiful in its method. But this guy has an enormous number of proteins being turned on and being affected by other cascades. It's a whopping cascade. It is a huge cascade of events. And with every event in this cascade, there has to be regulation. With every event. Just like glycolysis, you couldn't just have one bypass at the front. You have to be able to regulate every step along the way, and to some extent you can, at least the irreversible ones. So for this one, regulation has to happen at every event. So at the same time as you have self-regulation by the GTPase activity, you have another enzyme involved cutting back this signal. You have other enzymes involved in regulating this whole set of protein phosphorylations. So you have the counter activity of numerous enzymes. Along the way. And this kind of cascade. And not just that one event all the way along. There are proteins that can be phosphorylated here by this binding event that will directly reverse these steps. Another cascade that we're going to get into tomorrow is the vasopressin cascade, a whole different set of enzymes, and it also crosstalks at all these different places. There are specific places where they will overlap and they will shut each other off. So one other way that it's regulated is you have to think again, you have to back off and get a whole cellular picture. This doesn't do justice to the fact that this is going on in every direction. Okay, you have to imagine the whole surface has these kinds of little shifts that are all these G proteins, these alpha subunits, these stimulatory, they're called GS proteins because they stimulate the adenylate cyclase. They're floating, and they're hitting as many adenylate cyclases as they can. In the same cells, there are somatostatin receptors. And somatostatin is involved in allowing crosstalk between these two cascades. It's moderating the insulin versus epinephrine and glucagon signal. Somatostatin has the same kind of receptors. They belong to the same adrenergic family, but they have a different overall structure, and they're called alpha instead of beta adrenergic receptors. And instead of using G proteins, when somatostatin binds to its receptor, it sends off G inhibitory proteins. Somatostatin has an alpha receptor and it binds to an inhibitory G protein. So somatostatin effectively sends off these inhibitory proteins, and where do they bind? To the adenylate cyclase. So if somatostatin is released because these two signals are going on at once, what's going to happen? It's going to shut down this pathway here. Because those inhibitory G protein alpha subunits are going to be sailing forward, and what are they going to hit? These, the same things as the stimulatory ones are hitting on all sides of the cell, they're going to flow around, and they're going to shut it down. So that's one way that crosstalk happens. You have an inhibitory subunit instead of a stimulatory one, so it's in effect blocking this guy's activity, because presumably both signals are being considered at once by the cell. Is this pretty frightening so far?
Yeah.
It is. I knew it would be. You see, that's why I fed you these before. There's always a reason. So keep eating, and we'll follow along. We'll pick up with it tomorrow, and please come down and have more bagels, because I really don't